has a remarkable legacy because her father, Tom Lantos, who had a lengthy career in Congress, was the founder of the Human Rights Committee in Congress and one of the great proponents of human rights. This wasn't a theoretical concern for him because he was a Holocaust survivor and the only Holocaust survivor ever elected to Congress. And Dr. Lantos Sweat carries on his work as the chair of the Tom Lantos Foundation. But she also does this as a professor teaching at Tufts University and based upon a four-year term on the U.S. Commission for International Religious Freedom. She served both as vice chair and chair of that commission. And that's the commission that makes recommendations to the president and to Congress about which countries in the world are violating religious freedom and have issues and problems with respect to religious freedom. So she's one of our country's leading experts on international religious freedom issues, and also a friend of BYU Law School. She's on our board of advisors and is a good friend of the law school, and someone who I am honored to count as a friend as well. Next to her is Kent Hill. Kent has also had a remarkable career. He began his career as a university president. Some of us aspire to end our careers as a university president, but he decided to start that way and spent about 9 years at that task, and then has had a very distinguished career working with World Vision, one of the leading international relief agencies that does humanitarian work around the world, and also working at USAID. He's now taking a position at a relatively new organization, which I'm hoping he'll tell us a little bit about, the Religious Freedom Institute, headquartered in Washington, D.C. And we're really happy to have him here with his wealth of really practical, on-the-ground experience trying to bring help to people in desperate need. And to my far left, your right, is my senior partner, colleague, and friend, Cole Durham. Believe it or not, Cole, we've been working together for 20 years. And we began teaching a class together. This turned into a casebook that we wrote to teach students about law and religion, and then to a professional collaboration that's spanned my entire professional life as a professor, which corresponds to about half of his professional life as a law professor. So I'm happy to count myself as his junior partner. What I wanted to do is to open with a question for each of our panelists, which is meant to invite an autobiographical reflection, which is to talk a little bit about themselves and their involvement with religious freedom internationally, how they came to this work, what that work has been, just a little bit of a sketch of their an introduction to them and their background. Katrina, could I let you begin?
Yes, of course. Well, it's such a real pleasure and joy for me to be here with all of you. I have to say that I feel particularly lucky because sometimes when I participate in conferences, my schedule is such that I fly in, I give my remarks, and then hurry out again. But I really feel I've been fed over these last 2 days by an extraordinary gathering of brilliant and wise people. Each panel and each breakout session has been just phenomenal, and I was only regretting that I couldn't go to more of them. And so before I tell you a little bit more about what led me to this work, I do want to just pay tribute to Brett and to Elizabeth and especially to Cole for what you have created here with the International Center. It is a tribute to you. It's a tribute to BYU that it has been the home and the sort of nurturing environment for a center that has extraordinary respect and admiration and is viewed as an institution of unquestioned integrity and achievement and excellence around the world when it comes to issues of international religious freedom and religious freedom more broadly. So it's a real huge achievement, and Cole is sort of the great wise man of this endeavor. There used to be an ad many years ago for a financial advisory firm, and somebody else is going to remember this one, but the tagline was, when E.F. Hutton, I was going to say that, when E.F. Hutton talks, people listen, you know, and everybody would sort of hush. And I feel like it's true about Cole Durham, that when Cole Durham talks, we all hush and we lean a little closer, because he has great vision and great insight when it comes to not only understanding the importance of these issues to building decent and pluralistic and rights-respecting societies, but to building a more decent, more tolerant, more pluralistic and rights-respecting world. And so, Cole, I really want to pay tribute to you for your vision in creating all this, and Brett, for your skill in sort of taking up that that torch. I'll say just a few words about my background. They've been hinted to by Brett in his introduction. I am the fortunate, the very blessed and very proud daughter of two Holocaust survivors. And when you are a daughter of Holocaust survivors, it's something that will define your whole life, for good in my case. And one of the reasons why I think, in the case of myself and my sister, that identity, that heritage, that tragic history that we inherited through our parents was nonetheless an overwhelmingly positive bequest and heritage, was because their experience of the Holocaust, this darkest time in human history, a time when someone like my father, a brilliant and passionately patriotic young Hungarian, became a hunted animal in his own country for one reason and one reason only, and that was his Jewish identity and his Jewish heritage. But my parents' experience of that terrible, terrible dark time was transformed by the fact that light came into that darkness for them. There was a remarkable Swedish diplomat, one of the great humanitarians of the past century, by the name of Raoul Wallenberg. And some of you I see nodding heads. Raoul Wallenberg was the Swedish scion of one of Sweden's most powerful and rich and prominent families, really the Rockefellers of Sweden. That's who the Wallenbergs were. But he left the safety and the comfort and the security and the neutrality of Sweden at the height of the Final Solution to go to Hungary with one mission, which was to try and rescue what remained of the Hungarian Jewish community to whatever extent he could. My mother tells me that he was legendary. They called him our Moses from the North. He was their Moses from the North who had come to try and save people. And he had nothing in common with these people whom he came to help. He was rich and Christian and Swedish. They were, most of them, poor. They were hunted. They were persecuted. And they were Jewish. But what Raoul Wallenberg believed and understood was that what they had in common, their shared humanity, the essential and inestimable value of their human dignity, was far more important than what separated them. And so, and I don't have time because I'll steal the time from my other wonderful colleagues up here, but it's an extraordinary story. It's a bit of a Scarlet Pimpernel story, for those of you who know that great story. The creative and inventive and utterly undiplomatic ways in which this young Swedish diplomat conceived of ways to snatch lives from the machinery of death. And both of my parents, my father a little more directly, my mother a little more indirectly, owed their lives to Raoul Wallenberg. But they owed more than just their rescue for their actual lives, because the experience of having someone like that, who came into the midst of that hell, who made common cause with people with whom he had nothing in common, also rescued their belief in the fundamental goodness of life, in the potential goodness of people, in the importance of recognizing our shared humanity. And so we were brought up with the stories of Wallenberg, and we were brought up, my sister and I, with this incredible, incredible heritage. And so when my dad was elected to Congress as the first and only Holocaust survivor ever to be elected, he did in fact become the founder of the Congressional Human Rights Caucus, which after his death was reconstituted as the Tom Lantos Human Rights Commission of the United States Congress. And he remained always a profoundly optimistic man, despite all he had seen, the worst of humanity, all he had personally experienced and lost and suffered. I remember him telling me on many occasions when I would feel overwhelmed by the little crises in my lives and the little setbacks and the little dangers, he would say to me in his charming and distinguished Hungarian accent, he'd say, "Oh, darling, don't worry. We are just bending a windy corner of history. And around the corner are bright blue skies and wonderful possibilities." So as we come to the conclusion of this marvelous conference, thinking about the challenges, and they are real, and the threats, and they are real, and your questions will lead us to discuss some of those, I am heartened when I remember those words of my father. We're bending perhaps a windy corner of history, but we can get around it, and there will be bright skies and wonderful possibilities ahead.
In the providences of God, things don't always go in the direction you think they're going to go. I thought I was going to get a PhD in Russian history and teach Russian history, European history all my life. But during the Cold War, when I went to do research in Moscow, Russia, I happened to be right there when Russian Pentecostalists took up refuge in the basement of the American Embassy. And as a young graduate student, I was confronted with the reality of a kind of persecution I didn't even know existed. Ended up translating their materials and writing a book on religion in the Soviet Union. And my life ever since has had some kind of involvement with religious freedom. I did end up teaching for a few years. I didn't jump right into the presidency of a university. I taught, was tenured, but then I left all of that to head up a small NGO in Washington that worked on religious freedom. And it was during those years that your father had a big impact on me, because Tom Lantos, Chris Smith, Frank Wolf, these real heroes of religious freedom, became partners in working for Jews and for Christians in the Soviet Union. And I did that for a number of years. Then I did go to academia for 9 years, but ended up during the Bush years coming back and being put in charge of US foreign assistance to the former Soviet Union, Eastern Europe. And that was fascinating, because I got the opportunity to lecture in Russian in many quarters in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe to make the case that democracy is more than elections. If democracy does not include something like the First Amendment, if it does not include religious freedom, if it does not make it clear that there are things majorities cannot do, all you have is the possibility, or actually the certainty, of fascism developing out of elections. So I got to continue to do my religious work, religious freedom work there. Then went on and did some work at World Vision, the Templeton Foundation, and just within the last year have become a part of the Religious Freedom Institute, which is headed by Tom Farr in Washington, D.C., very closely connected to Georgetown University. I've been spending a lot of my time in recent months and years on the whole question of religious freedom in Muslim-majority countries, how to deal with Islamic extremism, how to work with moderates in the Muslim world who want to find within their own tradition what the Catholics found in Dignitatis Humanae in 1965, a well-developed, articulate defense of religious freedom. So it's great to be working full-time on international religious freedom again. It's not something I anticipated at the beginning of my career, but it's one that I've certainly enjoyed and look forward to working on for the next few years.
Well, it is true that Brett has fleshed me out, and I've been here over 40 years now. I started as I was the youngest person on the law school faculty for many years, and I didn't realize then that I should have been able to sit there as a, looking like a student, and then started teaching the class and taking people by surprise. But, I actually got very interested in religious freedom issues as a law student at Harvard. I did my third year paper on German church-state law, which sort of started introducing me to thinking about these issues not only in the American scene, which is the more typical pattern, but also thinking about things internationally. I was heavily involved with the American Association of Law Schools Law and Religion section for served as secretary for many years and then as chair. And then at the end of the 80s, shortly, well, in October of 1989, I became the secretary of the American Society of Comparative Law. About 3 weeks later, the wall came down in Berlin. About 3 months later, I started realizing that there were going to be just incredible opportunities from the vantage point of comparative law to work on the transformation that was going on in Europe. And so I spent the next, I just got into the business, if you will, of trying to put together teams working on various kinds of law reform projects in Eastern Europe. Most of the initiatives were coming, they were either American funded, in which case you'd get the ABA and the team of judges and people like that, or they would be EU or Council of Europe funded, in which case you'd get a bunch of Europeans. And what a few of us comparatists tried to do is to get both groups, because you'd get quite different perspectives. And our sense was that what people needed in the various, as they were working on law reform, was more options so they could think about what would work in their systems. Now, in the course of that, as issues in the nonprofit world more generally or on freedom of religion, religion issues came up, I would sort of gravitate to those projects. And as you start getting more and more experience, there's a kind of snowball effect. And indeed, I think I first experienced those early years of the 90s as I had a sense that there would be about 5 years of radical legal transformation, and then things would just sort of hold steady for who knows how many decades. Well, that's not how it really works. Religion is just so close to the center of culture that there are constant tinkerings and adjustments that are going on everywhere. And in the years after the first years of the 90s, we started realizing that there were great opportunities to engage with these processes wherever they would pop up around the world. And my sense is, you know, there are 200 countries in any given year. We have 15 or 20 countries that are working on some aspect of religion law. And there are court cases and administrative decisions going on pretty much everywhere. But we learned some things about how to get involved in those processes, how to bring people from a variety of perspectives and from a variety of national backgrounds to bear on these problems and to help people thinking about the problems. And that's led ultimately to the foundation of this center here and sort of extensive experience working on the laws of many countries.
Thanks to each of you for helping set the stage with a little bit of your background. The next question I want to ask is, what are the biggest problems that you see around the world involving religious freedom? And as a separate question, what are the most acute crises that you see? Because those may be different, but what are the big issues and the pressing issues that you see? Why don't we go the opposite direction? Cole, should we start with you with that?
Thank you. That gives me more flexibility. let me start with, acute problems. I would say there are a set of really acute problems that are linked to the whole refugee crisis. Right now, we have something on the order of 65 million refugees or displaced persons. This is the largest number in history, really. It's absolutely staggering. A huge number of these are in Syria, Turkey, Jordan. Unimaginable how those little countries are dealing with the burdens that this brings with it. But many of these issues are, in profound ways, religion-related, because either people are being driven because of fear. We've seen just a hemorrhage of Christians moving out of the Middle East. We've seen warfare in a number of areas that is often, you know, you look at it and it could be called ethnic, it could be called other kinds of things, but there's often a religious factor, if only as a marker of who the sides are in things. So there are a whole cluster of issues related to that that are, I think, really crisis issues. We're seeing, for some religious groups, crisis situations. I think of what's happening in Russia with the deregistration of the Jehovah's Witnesses and a kind of progressive first characterizing a lot of their literature as extremist literature, and then calling them on the fact that they continue to distribute it, and then using that as a basis for dissolving the legal entities that through which they're set up around Russia. We're seeing another wave with the top five leaders of Scientology have just been arrested within the past month. So those kinds of issues, but those are things that are happening around the world. If you look at the headlines resource on our website that just looks at what's happening day by day, you will see similar kinds of things happening. I think violence in the name of religion is just a huge factor. I usually look at the last 2 days of things on the headlines, and I seldom need to go further, but here are just a few things. Four more Copts, that's Christian Copts in Egypt, killed in most aggressive campaign in history of modern Egypt. Third Iranian convert given lengthy sentence alongside a pastor. Iran sentences four more Christians to 20 years in jail. Church officials upset that Myanmar won't allow UN fact finders. Islamic State loses most of Mosul. Well, that doesn't happen every day, but that's Bible distribution in China is still a problem. You get the picture. I mean, there are just all kinds of these issues like that. I think in terms of longer term sorts of issues and big issues, one of the amazingly difficult and residual issues is registration of religious organizations or the right to acquire legal entity status. That's gone through significant transformation and improvement, basically because of developments in the European, in the Council of Europe and the European Court of Human Rights. But that's had some global impacts, but it remains a huge problem area. I think another big question is, can other traditions go through something like the Second Vatican Council experience of the Catholic tradition? That is, it's a tradition which very much affirms its truth claims, but one of the truth claims is that human beings have dignity, and that was worked out in profound ways in the Second Vatican Council. And it is meant that there is respect from within the Catholic tradition for other traditions. And I think that whether that can happen within Orthodox Christianity, whether it can happen within Islam, I mean, it's much more complicated, but something like that is really vital if some of the big problems are to be solved.
Kent, I think that relates a little bit to one of the things you were going to talk about.
Right, I think it does. I'll just say something about from 50,000 feet. This last April, the Pew folks released their report, which they do annually, and it did show that 79% of the world's population live in countries where there is quite serious persecution or discrimination against religious believers. It's an unbelievable statistic, and it represented a growth of 5% over the year before, and those are for the most recent statistics we have, but it's probably worse now than then.
They're the Grimm statistics.
The
right?
Grimm statistics.
Because Brian Grimm.
Brian Grimm is involved in all of that, who's left us now for today. But here's what I want to say about this. It's not just because of violent Islamic extremism. If you look at the Middle East, for example, or you take a look at the end of the Ottoman Empire, the early 20th century, and what happened in Turkey, the 3.5 million Assyrians and Armenians and Greeks who were either killed or expelled during a genocidal period. These numbers are staggering compared to even what we've seen in the last few years. If you look at the Christian population over the last 100 years in the Middle East, it's not just since the invasion of Iraq, which has in fact resulted in 80 to 90% of all the Christians in Iraq being either displaced or refugees, or the beginning of the civil war in Syria in 2011, where again, maybe 80% of the Christians have been displaced or left. But even over the last century, the demise, the decline of Christians and other minorities is very, very significant. The point I want to make here is it's not just a question of protecting the Christians and Yazidis and other minorities. Any area that becomes deprived of minorities is unsafe for its own citizens and its neighbors. We need pluralism in the Middle East. And a lot of the problem has been brutal authoritarian regimes. It's been ethnic nationalism. And yes, to some extent, it's been violent Islamic extremism. And the end of the Islamic State will not put an end to this because the extremism that gave birth to it is still there. And I think what Cole said is exactly right. The Religious Freedom Institute, where I work, we're having a dialogue in Rome with Muslim leaders in December. And the topic is precisely how Muslims can find within their own tradition, the Quran, the Hadiths, those elements that promote human rights and religious freedom, no compulsion in religion. And there are a lot of Muslims who want to see that trajectory developed. That's got to happen. Because in South and Southeast Asia, what we've been seeing happening in the Middle East is beginning to happen more there. We had, remember, 80% of all the Muslims in the world are not in the Middle East, and they're not Arab, and they haven't always been intolerant at all. And we had hoped that that influence might go to the Middle East, but the evidence right now is that the pressure from Saudi and the Wahhabis, et cetera, is going that direction. So we've got a lot of work to do to work on extremism, and at its source, it's going to depend on finding a way to resurrect what human dignity means and why it has nothing to do with something that the state has the right to give. It has the obligation to protect. It does not have the right to give. We've got to find a way to use religions and secular voices to have a rebirth of an understanding of what human dignity means.
I think that that's a really profound point that Kent just made, and I could talk both about the immediate crises. I mean, they take different forms. We've talked already a little bit about the threats posed by radical Islamic extremism, and those threats are very real, and we have seen the results, tragic results in the Middle East, tragic results in terms of the devastation of the Christian communities in the lands where they were born, in the land of Christianity's birth, the lands. But we also have then other threats to religious freedom that come from aggressively secular states like China. And one of the reasons that Pew figure is so high is that China, with over a billion people, is a country that places enormous restrictions and poses great threats to religious freedom. And so that is sort of one source of the threat. Perhaps, in my view, you know, one of the single darkest holes in terms of human rights more broadly and religious freedom would be North Korea, which we know is threatening the world in other ways as well. But there you have a very odd situation of a quasi-religious deification of a ruling family now in its third generation, where in point of fact, Kim Jong-un and his father and his grandfather are not viewed simply as, you know, sort of the autocratic rulers or even the kings, but something on a quasi, semi-deified status. So that's its own very weird world where there's brutal, brutal oppression and persecution of any sort of religious practice there. But to go to that 50,000 foot altitude that you were at a moment ago, oh, there was one other thing I wanted to mention, because I think sometimes it's helpful to have a counter narrative. One very grave circumstance as it relates to religious freedom in the world today has to do with the persecuted Rohingya Muslims of Burma. And I like to bring that up for audiences in America. It's a very troubling and difficult and sad situation, but we tend to have a narrative, if we're really honest and sort of dealing with things at a superficial level, Muslims, you know, radical, extremist, dangerous, Buddhist, peaceful, loving, calm, gentle people. Well, just so you don't get too comfortable in your preconceptions about good guys and bad guys, in Burma, it is a Muslim community that is among the most persecuted religious minorities in the world today. And they are being persecuted by the majority Buddhist community. So I think that it's important to be aware of it, because it does disrupt some of our preconceptions and some of our maybe too comfortable narratives. But if I can address for a moment another dimension of that 50,000 foot altitude perspective and how we think in a big way about why we are having all these problems and what some of the solutions might be. You know, maybe a few decades back, there was something that was very popular, which was sort of called the secularization thesis. And it basically posited that as societies became more highly educated and more affluent and more modern, that they would inevitably become more secular. And as they secularized more, religion and faith and all of that would become sort of vestigial appendices, you know, appendages to sort of modern life. And people might still like some of their traditions. And of course, there would always be some element of faith and religiosity and that in communities, but that it would become increasingly irrelevant and less significant in people's lives. And Europe seemed to be sort of the vivid, you know, case study that proved the point. You know, Europe, wealthy and modern and highly educated and increasingly very secular, and the church is little more than pretty buildings in the communities, and you know, that was sort of that, and that was the way of the world. Well, over the last 20 years, there have been a lot of shocks and disruptions and you know, disproving of the so-called secularization thesis, because many of those early, you know, threats that came, for example, to the United States in the form of the attacks on 9/11 didn't come from poor and uneducated individuals, but came from very affluent and highly educated individuals who were anything but secularized. On the contrary, they were more deeply engaged and more radically engaged with their faith than ever before. And that radicalization that we've seen in large measure coming from the Muslim world has caused a sort of rethinking, and I think in some ways an awareness on the part of some of those same highly secularized Western elites that we have misunderstood the hold that faith can have for very good or for not so good in people's lives. And one of the ways I think in which this has really challenged Western notions of separation of church and state and secularization has been with the recruitment of young Western, well-off, well-educated Muslim men and women into jihadi organizations, leaving their comfortable homes to participate in what to most in the West seem like incomprehensible and evil causes and jihads. And to me, as I look at this, I cannot help but escape the feeling that with our wealth, with our materialism, with our secularization, with our tendency to marginalize the role of faith, the essential role of faith in giving purpose and meaning to people's lives, we too often leave a huge, enormous, gaping hole of meaning and purpose in the lives of young people. They know that there must be something more. There must be some greater purpose for existence than how many degrees they can acquire and what their income can be and how big of a house they can get and do they have the latest tennis shoes and do they have the latest, you know, device and the fastest, you know, 8LG. I don't even know what those terms mean. But people understand that at the end, the pursuit of those things leaves a kind of emptiness. And so I feel, and this is a much bigger discussion than can certainly be resolved at a time like this, but that we have to grapple, those of us who are people of faith, living in secular societies, living in that modern materialistic world that we inhabit, have to find a way to communicate to the rising generation that we get it, that there must be a greater purpose to life. And we must find a way to incorporate that in appropriate ways, in constitutional ways, into the way that we build our societies. Because when people feel that emptiness, when they feel that big hole and that purposelessness to some of the things that we seem to be about in this day and age, they will seek for it somewhere. And I'm often reminded of the line from a very famous poem by, I believe it's Yeats, and I have to look this up because I quote it all the time, but I haven't sort of researched it. But the line, which I'm sure will be familiar to some of you, is, the worst are filled with passionate intensity, while the best lack all conviction. Well, we need to build societies in which the best are filled with equal passionate intensity, not violent, not dangerous, not hateful, but passionate nonetheless. Because when passionate intensity encounters a lack of conviction, very often, even if it's wrong, the passionate intensity will carry the day.
Your responses, each of them, really lead to the next question I want to focus on. And that's, what is the role of religion, religious people and religious institutions in responding to the challenges of religious freedom? We know that those who are religious majorities in one place can be persecutors, whereas in other situations where they're minorities, they may be the persecuted. And yet, for some reason, having the moral imagination to recognize that we're in a global world and none of us are majorities, we're all really minorities, is conceptually difficult for us. So I guess my question is, and Kent, let me start with you, because I know you've been thinking about this issue. What are some of the ways that religions and religious people can be involved in addressing these issues? And maybe you can say a little bit more about your thinking about Islam and the ways in which Islam may find resources within its tradition for tolerance and dignity.
Right. You know, one of our speakers this morning made the comment that religious freedom is important because religion is important. And it reminds me, I think it was Blaise Pascal in the 17th century said, for the want of a good object upon which to focus its attention, the soul will certainly focus on a bad. The soul, like nature, abhors a vacuum. We are religious creatures. We ask religious questions. We are not ultimately satisfied by just meeting material needs. The growing emptiness in the West, just as Katrina said, is a serious problem. Not just a problem for the people with the emptiness, the nuns who are not sure quite what they believe. It's also a serious problem for advocacy of religious freedom. I've become increasingly convinced that the campaign to defend religious freedom in the West, which is going to be critical if we're to address the international religious freedom problems, has got to be addressed. You cannot defend something you no longer are particularly passionate about. And we've lost a lot of our passion about that. And this has led me to a conclusion I'm sort of surprised about. I've been in many occasions where I'll give speeches on religious freedom and why it's important, all the virtues of it, et cetera. And that's fine. We can use our reason to make our case. But I've about decided that we need to not so much defend religious freedom as exercise it. And what I mean by that is people who understand that God matters, that asking difficult questions and trying to find out what our place in the universe is, we need to do that. We need to reflect those views. We need to be faithful to what we believe. Because if it's really true what religious people believe, that there are physical and spiritual laws in the universe, that truth does not reside in us, that we just make it up, decide on a given day what's right and wrong, that we try to access objective standards of truth that do not come from within us. If that's true, and if there are consequences for violating physical and spiritual laws, you know, you can say if you want to that you don't believe in the law of gravity, and you can walk out the 10th store of a store of a, you know, and you're going to get concrete evidence to the contrary. It's the same in the spiritual world. If it's true that transcendent matters matter, that God exists, that we're not compelled to believe, but if we honor God's laws, good things happen. If we don't, bad things happen. Families fall apart. Social structures fall apart. If that's true, imagine, in the West where we're getting more and more secular, if that's true, the darkness will grow, and any place there is genuine religious belief, those places will shine like a brighter and brighter candle. And people will ask the question, what is the source of that security and that family harmony and the way you treat each other? And they will learn about human dignity and the fact that we believe it comes from God, given to us as a gift from on high. A lot of the most prominent thinkers today, think of Charles Taylor, the Canadian academic, who studied secularism. He said, you know, we make arguments to the secular world now, and we have not noticed that they do not understand our language. It's not that they disagree with us or reject what we say. It's like we're speaking Arabic or Chinese. In this culture, the only thing that catches people's attention is authentically lived religious lives. If that grows, then the constituency that understands human dignity and the source of human dignity, that can grow as well. So ironically, the best way to defend religious freedom is to be faithful to religious traditions instead of just nominally say we're something or the other. And in fact, we're just like our secular neighbors. We need to be serious believers if we're going to convince the world that in fact religious freedom matters, because religion matters.
I certainly endorse all of that. I'm just thinking of a couple of other things. First, it is clear that religious leaders in particular have a lot of responsibility and can really make a difference. I think of the civil war in Yugoslavia, and part of the problem was that you had clerics coming out as on the Serbian side or the Croatian side, and some of the solutions also started happening when those leaders could get together and talk to each other and so forth. Now, this is more complex than people think, because people assume that religious leaders are teaching religions of peace and so forth. The problem is religious leaders, well, they may be trained to deal with sort of conflict in marital situations, in pastoral situations, but they're not trained to deal with conflict in international situations. And so there is some need for specialization, for ability to deal with more complex kinds of situations. But that qualification aside, religious leaders can make a tremendous difference. They can be bridge builders. They can, there was a meeting probably in the past couple of weeks, arranged by Alon Goshen Gottstein, a Jewish rabbi, but had the Pope and leaders of many other traditions, and the message was, meet people from other traditions. And just that bridge building, if it's done, can make a big difference. There's another thing that I think is really important. We've talked here, and I think, I believe deeply that one of the things that's very important is that religious people have to have a place in the public sphere, and that it can't become anathema to bring religious premises into the public square. I think we have to be wise. We have to be sensible. You have to, if you're talking with other people, you have to speak languages that they understand. So we sometimes have an obligation to translate some of those premises. Now, there's a little debate on who has the higher burden of translation. You know, if it's a, normally if you're the speaking the second language and you're speaking with a native speaker, you look to the native speaker for the translation. So in the dialogue between secularists and religious speakers, the secular speakers are saying, you religious people need to translate for us. And maybe they need to do more work themselves. On the other hand, I have a very secular friend who said, well, that's nice, but if you're really right that I'm blind and you're seeing things, maybe you need to do some of the translation. So I'm not sure which way the translation cuts. I think as we do this, though, it's important not only that the ideas are there, but there's a role that religions need to play in deepening and articulating their worldviews. I think religious freedom is important because it protects not only religious ideas, but religious worldviews. And when we're dealing with religious debate or conflicts, we're not really talking about sort of a debate in the normal sense. It's how do you communicate from different perspectives, from within different paradigms. And if we don't now one move is to try and just shift to the secular ground and make the secular arguments. But there's a certain sense in which if you abandon your premises, you're defeated in advance. You need those premises. But you need to understand those premises and to understand them in profound ways. And I think religions have an obligation to really mine their own resources, to come to understand them more deeply. In the same way when we learn another language, you learn your own language more deeply when you've learned another language. We need to learn those things so that we can draw on our premises, but we can really use them. And that also demands deep work within religious traditions.
Dr. Lantos-Sweat, what do you think about the role of religion and religious individuals in promoting religious freedom?
Well, I love what both Kent and Cole have said. I'm trying to think what I might add that would bring another dimension to it. I remember an experience I had a couple of years ago when one of the sort of Concord, I live in not directly in Concord, New Hampshire, but in a little town called Bow, New Hampshire. And if there are any Christian Scientists here with us today. They will recognize Bow, New Hampshire, because it's the birthplace of Mary Baker Eddy. But other than that, it's a very small community of 7,000 people. But we're right next to the state capital of Concord, which is a huge metropolis of 40,000 people. So New Hampshire is a small state. But the Concord Area Interfaith Council had invited a group of Christian and Muslim religious leaders from Egypt to come and sort of do a visit in the United States and in our area. And I had been asked to come and sort of meet with them and speak with this group at a luncheon at one of the local churches. And it was really interesting because when I went into the room, it was a very, I wouldn't go so far as to say tense atmosphere, but it was not a congenial atmosphere. You could tell that the neither group was feeling particularly friendly towards each other. I think the whole idea had been interfaith dialogue and come to neutral turf and, you know, can't we all just get along? But they also didn't seem terribly, like they had terribly simpatico feelings towards their American host, towards the hosts. And I sort of came into that situation and it struck me right away that part of the problem was that the American hosts and the people organizing this were viewing these individuals, these two groups of individuals, as very interesting, nice sort of museum specimens. They weren't really speaking to them as people of faith, one person of faith connecting to another person of faith, but sort of as, oh, here you are, interesting artifacts from a troubled region, and we want to help you, interesting artifacts. And I totally got it, that it was very, very off-putting. So I sort of just went around the table sitting with different smaller groups. It was a kind of a long table and talking about my life and my faith. I'm a mother of seven children. It's so challenging to raise your children in your faith nowadays and sort of arm them to withstand all the temptations and threats that are out there in this world, you know, rampant sex and pornography and drugs and, you know, kind of having those sorts of conversations. And there immediately the walls came down because they said, oh, we found somebody in America who takes her faith seriously. This is not somebody looking at us from a superior perch, you know, sort of trying to explain to we idiots and we fools who take our faith seriously. We are Muslims and we take our faith seriously. We are ancient Christian communities. We take our faith seriously. It's not just part of our lives. It's the center of our lives. Here's somebody who's talking to us as though that's her reality as well. And sort of that barrier came down, and that was a moment of revelation and insight for me that I think relates exactly to what you were saying, Kent.
Yeah, if I could just add something on that. This question of communication with others of very strong belief, like Muslims and Christians, or the communication between people who call themselves people of faith and the nuns or the secular. I think there's something we need to remember here. It was in 2008 that a group of sheikhs and mullahs and Muslim leaders from all over the world, Islamic leaders from all over the world, came up with something called a common word between us and you, I think it was called. And what they said was, we have many differences, but we have something in common with you Christians. We all believe in two commandments, the commandment to love God and the commandment to love our neighbor. If we can be faithful to this, we have the basis for dialogue and even working together, etc. And that was responded by some faculty at Yale. I forget what they called the document, but it was eventually signed by hundreds of Christian leaders saying, we affirm that, and it was the beginning of some very fruitful discussions saying, despite the differences, we have something in common. But what we often miss is we have something in common with secular people too, if we let our theology guide us. I think it's in the first chapter of John, that one of the most beautiful theological chapters in all of the New Testament. We talk about, John coming into the world as the precursor of Christ and, you know, et cetera. And there's a verse in there which talks about the light is coming into the world, the same light that comes to every person. I mean, our theology tells us that the divine light is present in everyone, whether they acknowledge God or not. You might call it conscience, whatever you want to call it is fine. It means that we have the right to believe that people of goodwill, of which there are enormous numbers who are confused or uncertain right now, doesn't mean they're not, don't have impulses for good. You find that common ground. And if, because of your religion, you live out well your own, you might even draw them into a deeper understanding for themselves. But there is a common language there, and we call it love, we call it goodness. If we exercise those virtues, acquire those virtues, we can communicate with anybody, including nuns.
I agree, and I do think that the part of the answer to the question you posed is that we must be ready to show our heart and show the sincerity of our faith when we are trying to share the value of religious freedom, of tolerance, of openness with communities where that may not be their natural default. And they are much, much more likely to consider us credible interlocutors, credible partners, if they get it that, yeah, we have deep beliefs too. We understand we are not patronizing you. We are not sort of, you know, somehow trying to suggest that, oh, you know, because you're still in this primitive place where you take your faith seriously, where you think that the requirements and the demands of your religion should have a claim on your life. But we're going to try and be respectful of that while we bring you along to this more enlightened place. If they feel that you understand that because for you too, that is how your life is built, then they are much more likely to feel that there is a common ground and much more likely to say, well, you know, this person does take their beliefs seriously. They do honor it. They do give it a central role in their life. And yet, they have this welcoming and tolerant and respectful ability to accept other traditions and other faiths.
I would just add, I've thought for a long time, I remember reading a little book on the forgotten virtue of reverence. And it's written by someone who is a specialist on Greek tragedy and Greek art. But he pointed out that this is very much a kind of forgotten virtue, but it was very much at the heart of Greek thought, Greek tragedy. But what he drew out of that was the fact that we as human beings do respond to other people's sense of reverence. And it's that authenticity you're talking about. And I think being able to connect at that level is profoundly important. I remember as a law student feeling, you know, a little bit alienated in a very secular environment. And I knew the professors who were actually believers, and I had a trust level with them. There weren't a lot of them, but it made a big difference. And I mean, that's a small example, but I think in general, one of the things that we need to do is to cultivate that sensitivity and show our respect for the reverence that other people feel, because it's very deep and a very connecting kind of thing.
I love the way you put that, Cole. It's so true, and it's such a good way of summarizing it. And I want to share one little episode from when we lived in Denmark. My children attended an international school, which was a fantastic experience. It was like a small United Nations. I think 50 different countries were represented in the school. And talking about that sense of admiration for someone else's reverence, I'll never forget our son Keaton played on the little school basketball team. And there was a Muslim boy on the team named Ismail, and Keto called him Izzy. And I remember Keto coming home one day with just this admiration shining in his eyes. He said, "Mom, I admire Izzy so much because it's Ramadan, and so he has to fast. every day from sun up till sundown. And he's really hungry when he comes to basketball practice. And he's kind of weak, but he comes. But, you know, even though we're all like, well, Izzy, you know, just have an energy bar, just have, you know, some water and, you know, it'll be okay. But he's so faithful, you know, and in our tradition, we would fast once a month on what's called Fast Sunday. And that was hard enough for my children. But it's what you're talking about. He had such admiration for the reverence and the fidelity to his religious obligations that he saw in this young man. And I could see what a building block that was, what a big building block that was in building respect for the virtue, the reverence, the faithfulness of someone from a very different tradition.
We could say something about the cultivating the virtue of humility in all this, because I had a recent experience where I was talking to a large group of people at the National Press Club, and we were talking about Islam and Islamic extremism, etc., and defending religious freedom. And I happened to note, I simply happened to make the observation that even when there is a reasonably well articulated and theologically cogent doctrine of religious freedom, it does not mean that we as believers are even faithful to what we say we believe. And I gave two examples. I said it was in the mid-1990s in Rwanda, which had the highest percentage of Christians in Africa, that there was a terrible genocide in which Christians were involved and participated in this. And halfway through the 100 days that killed 800,000 people with machetes, Pope John Paul II sent a letter, made a public statement, that there were Catholics involved in genocide. We're not always faithful. Now, there were Catholic victims as well. I don't mean to be one-sided here, and there were Protestants involved. But my point is, we are often not faithful to the best that's in our traditions. And I gave a second example, of course, from a Balkan history, the 90s as well, where Muslim boys and men were taken out and massacred, and Muslim women raped by Christians. Now, they didn't try to defend it with Christian theology like the Islamic State does, but they certainly were not faithful to the teachings of Jesus Christ. And so I just acknowledge that as we move towards a world of treating people well, none of us have completely clean hands. I finished the speech, I walked off the stage, and this man came, you know, striding up the front, a Muslim man, threw his arms around me, and just thanked me, just for acknowledging that, you know, we as Christians haven't always been perfect either. We have our own skeletons in the closet. We can learn from each other. But we are all human beings. We fall short of what we and the best in our traditions. And sometimes just being humble about falling short sets the stage for working together so that we can all pull from the best of our traditions to live more in accord with what we know in our heart is the right thing to do and be.
The truth is, we often have a lot more to be humble about than we think. I remember in the early 2000s, there was a lot going on in the OSCE about anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, Christianity. This was the birth of all phobias, I sometimes thought. But a lot of conferences were held, and one of the things that Christians would point out with sort of a degree of victimhood was that Christians were the most persecuted group. What they neglected to mention is that much of the persecution of that group came not from Muslims, but from other Christians. So there's a lot to remember humility.
Is there anyone in the audience who would like to join the conversation and ask a question of our panel? Wait for the microphone to come so that we can get you picked up on our recording.
So in the quest to understand what one can do in this great effort, I keep getting hung up on the grim statistics, which are 80% of the world is living in areas with low protections of religious freedom, and a big chunk of that comes from parts of the world. You have the Chinas of the world, you have the Middle Eastern and other countries of the world that is the source of those statistics. And I keep saying to myself, but am I doing anything about that? And should I worry about doing anything about that? It seems to me that the model that we're talking about for doing things about this is essentially a one-on-one model. All of the discussions we're having here are elements of and ways of communicating better, more empathetically, which I think is extremely important. We know in the LDS tradition that, in fact, Christ will prevail on a one-by-one basis. We convert people and we help people one-by-one. Is that the model, and is that what we're talking about? I think all the conferences we do and all the things we're trying to do, you know, with your foundations and things, at the end of the day is bringing specific people together to have these better conversations, and one by one, we conquer and create religious freedom in that way. Or are there more potent ways of going about this, you know, where there'd be more efficiency in accomplishing the goal? So this issue is just dominating my thinking. I think I can do the one by one, but I have a quest for more.
Just real quickly here. I love that question because we have tended to do something here that we don't always do, which is to talk a lot more about root causes of the kinds of things that undermine support for religious freedom. But we're all pragmatists here. We've all been involved in the trenches on this. We all believe that there are things the U.S. government could do that would be much more effective. It was 2008 that Tom Farr, the president of the Religious Freedom Institute, wrote this magnificent book explaining what the connection was between U.S. national interest, national security, doing the right thing. I mean, you used it in your speech yesterday. You said it's not only the right thing to do, it's the smart thing to do. Empirically, we know that everywhere religious freedom exists, every other good indicator of a society goes up, economically, peaceful, etc. We ought to use those pragmatic arguments. Our State Department ought to use it. Our administration ought to nominate and get the next U.S. ambassador for religious freedom. If we, you know, this is a tragedy that we don't even think that we can do anything enough to get somebody in place with authority who could do something. Now, we've given 24 pages of recommendation to this administration. We did the same thing to President Obama. It's not a partisan thing. Of things concretely that can be done that can advance international religious freedom. So this is not just a question of people being faithful religiously. There are concrete things we can do. And you've been in the heart of this for a long, long time as well. And I'd be interested, for example, in your work in the commission, did you see a difference depending on, you know, what you actually did?
Well, I want to give a hearty amen to everything Kent said, because absolutely there is so much more that could be done at a policy and governmental level. And the sad reality is, and Tom Farr has been fabulous on this stuff, he gets it, but with human rights more broadly and with religious freedom more narrowly, our State Department, and frankly, most administrations, this was absolutely true of the Obama administration, and so far it's very true of the Trump administration, they periodically like to trot out a rhetorical flourish here and there, but there is no serious policy commitment to putting the advancement of these very important goals at the heart of our policy. And there are very practical, pragmatic arguments for doing so. You remember I said yesterday that if you were to line up the countries from which our gravest national threats derive, security threats, with the countries that are the most abusive on religious freedom grounds, they would line up to a remarkable degree. So I think that, you know, there are a whole range of things we can do. I'll just give you one little example. I was talking about this at lunch with some of the people I was having lunch with. Our foundation is part of an internet freedom coalition. And we like to say that the internet firewalls that countries like China and Iran and others put up are sort of the 21st century equivalent of the Berlin Wall. With a tiny, modest reallocation of existing, already appropriated funds to the State Department and to the BBG, which is the Broadcasting Board of Governors, which runs all of our international communications efforts, Voice of America, Radio Marti, Radio Free Asia, all of those, with a small, as they say, reallocation of some of those already, you know, large funding pots towards technologies that exist but need some help and support that can provide privacy tools, anti-censorship tools, and above all, firewall circumvention tools. Hundreds of millions of people in closed societies, including religious believers, many of whom are heavily persecuted, could have free, anonymous, safe access to the internet. This is a small thing that we could do, that we should do. And, you know, we're not talking hundreds of millions of dollars. The budget, for example, for BBG is about $750 million a year. 5% of that budget, $35 million from them, and, you know, another $20 million from the State Department would have a transformative effect in our technological ability to tear down these modern Berlin walls. The symbolic impact, if, you know, President Trump, and I'm not going to hold my breath, but, you know, if President Obama, when he was in office, when they went to China, had insisted on going to worship at a small house church or a legitimate bona fide Catholic church, not one of the state-run ones, if they had, you know, just said, hey, I'm here, I'm the President of the United States of America, and I'm going to go and stand in solidarity with persecuted religious believers in your country, that would have an enormous impact. And at the end of the day, of course, it is always the people within a country that have to be the real change agents. But they are sustained and supported and encouraged. And, you know, you think about that word encourage, it's to infuse with courage. They are infused with courage when those who live in free societies stand up for them, stand up for their rights. So there are specific concrete things related to, you know, filling the post of ambassador at large for religious freedom, filling the post, which remains empty, of special envoy to combat, monitor and combat anti-Semitism. There are symbolic things we can do. There are, you know, policy initiatives in the Congress. So there is a lot more that can be done. And what each one of you could do, and what I hope each one of you do, is in point of fact, reach out and communicate to the White House and to your member of Congress. Say, I care about religious freedom, not only because it's a value that I cherish, but because I think advancing this right is in our national interest from a security perspective, from an economic perspective, from many, many different perspectives. I want you to raise the priority of this in your administration. I want the Congress to focus on this more. And that is something concrete that you can do.
Let me just, sort of another angle is very much what we've been engaged in, and that is within each country there are a limited number of people who really shape and affect religion policy. And simply by getting to know those people, having opportunities to talk about these issues with people, and often just pointing out very practical things they can do to make things better that are not going to sort of rock the boat unduly politically in their home countries. I think establishing these kinds of networks is phenomenally important, and really in many parts of the world is really, you know, one of the major hopes for doing things. I mean, this takes, I mean, it takes resources. But I think that's another angle, and There are a lot of NGOs doing this kind of work. There are ways of doing it that I think reach a lot of people.
I wanted to see if we could have one more question from maybe someone who hasn't had a chance yet today. Yes, gentleman on the third, fourth row. Yes, right. I'm sorry, back this way. Right here. Yeah, thanks.
Hi. I'm noticing I'm one of the more.
Microphone close.
Oh, I'm noticing I'm one of the more junior members in this cause, and I'm more so just wondering, what do you foresee in 10 to 20 years, and how our roles may be different to build upon the foundation that you guys are now laying?
Thank you. It's a great closing question. What do you see as you look to the horizon? Kent, do you want to start on that?
You know, I think the great temptation for people who see a big problem is to despair and to decide that really I can't do anything. I'm not even sure what I should do. And even if I wanted to do something, I would make no difference. And I would just point out that despair is not a Christian virtue. And the truth is, we're not called to do everything. We can't do everything. Each one of us has a certain capacity to do something. And we need to do that. I think the answer to your question will depend on whether enough individuals and communities simply do what is in their power to do. I think it was Edmund Burke who said, the only thing necessary for evil to triumph is for good people, he said men, of course, but good people to do nothing. And so we have to do what each of us can do. And I'll just end with a line from Albert Camus that I've quoted to myself whenever I'm tempted to despair. He said, perhaps we can do nothing about living in a world where children suffer, but we can limit the number who do. And we have to approach all of this like that.
Well, you know, I started out talking about my father and bending the windy corner of history, and I really loved that spirit of optimism that he had. And I think that we have to have that spirit of optimism because the alternative is not a position of faith. It is a position of despair. And that really isn't acceptable for people who do believe and sense very deeply that God is sovereign, that we are beloved children of his, that he cares about our fate and our destiny, and that he has put some of that responsibility into our hands. So I think, I want to agree with what Kent said earlier, that I think it begins with living authentic lives yourselves. It begins with having the courage of your convictions, being filled with that sort of passionate intensity. I do think, this is a personal belief of mine, that, you know, there are different ways in which, you know, we're all called to serve and to utilize our talents. And so that's kind of an individual obligation for each one of us to seek out that path. You know, what is my gift? How can I serve? What is it that I can do well and that I feel called to do? And then be ready to answer that call. But then, you know, to be, to take a certain pride in the fact that, yes, you, each of us, has a role to play in how the drama plays out. I can tell you and I both love to quote people, so I'm going to throw in another quote as well. And this is Shakespeare from The Tempest. And the piece of it that's very familiar to everybody is the line he had that said, the past is prologue. We've all seen that quoted somewhere, but we rarely hear the rest of it. What follows that line, that the past is prologue, is what's to come is in yours and my discharge. So what is to come is in our hands. It's not written in the stars. It is in our hands. And so, you know, obviously I can't but help but be filled with greater optimism, seeing, you know, this wonderful audience out here, seeing the way in which you are all engaging with us. It's fun to be up here and see how earnestly you're listening and engaging and taking in what it is we are saying. And I guess I would just hope that everybody will leave this important conference feeling a sense of mission, feeling a calling to do more and to seek out what it is that you are to do to live out your belief and your convictions more fully, and to undertake that task of building a world, building societies, building communities in which that right of people to live lives of integrity, live lives that reflect their deepest beliefs, building communities where that is preserved for all of us. And I am confident and I am optimistic as I look to the future.
Is this stopped working? So I agree with that. And I suspect that people will come to the end of this 2 days more highly motivated to try and do something. But one of the things I've found is it's phenomenally difficult to articulate what that is. So one of the things I hope for within the next 20 years is we'll figure out more effectively what concrete things people can do. Now, I've actually thought a lot about this. I have a reputation for not having a sense for how to do concrete things. But I've thought a lot about it, and I know this is very difficult, actually, because there are risks. What we don't need is more people, zeal, great phrase, zeal without knowledge. Zeal without knowledge is quite dangerous. And even zeal with knowledge can be dangerous if it's not channeled in appropriate ways. And that's one of the things that makes it difficult. Another thing that makes it difficult is some of the things that need to be done, things that can be done with legislators, things that can be done at foreign policy levels, really do require some expertise. And so I think one of the things that we're doing is contributing at various levels to greater expertise. If you listen to church leaders when they get to the end, most of the major leaders of our church have given major addresses now on religious freedom. They get the significance. I mean, I love Elder Hale's statement, don't walk, run to work for these things. But it's hard. And one of the first things is get knowledge. I mean, I think that's really a critical step. And the fact that we've started these sessions each year, which we anticipate will continue, is a way of contributing to that. But there are a lot of ways that knowledge can be expanded. But one of the things we also recognize is that people want to be able to do something with knowledge. For most of us, we have more opportunities in local settings. I tell people, well, one of the things about this conference is we've identified these pamphlets, which are very practical areas where people are facing things and can do things just by entering into discussions at local levels with teachers, with administrations, and so forth. And I think we need to get better at doing that. It needs to be done with understanding, with respect, with sophistication. I think we will find ways working with other people, of learning from others, and getting better at those kinds of things. One of the things that does come to mind, because part of our role is we have to do fundraising for all of this. I've been struck by late night TV advertising. And my wife and I are now, we can guess within about 5 cents of what any advertisement, what the price will be. It's either 1999 or 1995. And then there are multiples because you might have to do three of these. One thing you can do, and I apologize for blatant fundraising, go to our website, www.iclears.org, press on the contribute button, and consider 1999 alone or in multiples. Okay. But really, I mean, so there are very practical things that can be done. But I think in the end, this is something where people will get guidance. I think raising the awareness of how critical this is important, because I think then people will earnestly seek guidance. And guidance is something that people will get. The light of Christ comes into the world with every person, with every tradition, with secular traditions. And ultimately we need to respond to that. And I think we will get progressively better at doing that. And that's one of my hopes.
Well, we're going to transition immediately into our closing, which will be hopefully brief. Let me just add that humility, which we've heard an endorsement of, the first article I wrote as a law professor was a defense of humility and a plea for judges to embrace it. But humility does not mean hopelessness, it does not mean cluelessness, and it does not mean powerlessness. It begins with a disposition to listen and understand, but there's a tremendous courage that comes with humility, of a willingness to stand up for what you feel in your heart is right and true. And we live in a world where there's a tremendous pressure to conform and be silent, and having the courage to get educated, to get informed, and then to speak up, stand up, is really a challenge that I think we want to try to meet. For those of us who are Latter-day Saints, we have no choice but to be optimistic, even if by disposition we're inclined towards melancholy. We can't let it get the better of us, because we are required by virtue of the theology we embrace to be optimistic. And so it is easy to feel discouraged or even despair, but those are tools of Satan, not tools of the Savior. And our task, I think, is to, after we do what we can to educate ourselves and become informed, to have the courage to stand up, to speak up, and then to seek to magnify and amplify the truths that we understand. Please join me in thanking our panel, and let me invite Elizabeth Clark to come up, and we'll transition to our closing session.